Okay.
It's been a while.
We did our last interview, I think, in October. So,
yeah, so we're
all
a
right,
rusty.
Are we all set?
It's on. It says, yes.
Okay.
It says it's recording.
Yes, it's
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
All so right. Did you want to, let's just leave it at that because.
You don't want to rewind it and test it to make sure it's.
I think we're okay.
Up.
Yeah, I think we're okay. Yeah. This would be some special interest for people who are listening to the same set of tapes over and over again. They get a little different introduction. I'm sitting in the kitchen of Mr. Bob Kenyon. It's Nancy Peroso speaking, and it's May 25th, 2010. And Bea Cherniak is also sitting in on the interview operating the equipment. So I think we'll start with just asking a general question of having you introduce yourself and describing how you came to work in the grain industry.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bob Kenyon from 98 Kirkwall Crescent. I came from a rural background. So my father was a farmer up until I was 6 years old, but it seems that I always had an interest in farming. And worked on a farm, you know, when I was going to high school. So when I was finished high school, I came to the university and took agriculture. So graduated in 1959 as a Bachelor of Science in Agriculture. And I had taken, at that time, there was different options you could take, like animal science, plant science, dairy science, entomology, that sort of thing. I took plant science, which was more in the line of plant breeding and plant physiology and plant diseases and that sort of thing. So when I worked at the university for the summer, and the dean of the university knew the superintendent of Dominion Malting. So they met at some meeting or other, and he said he was looking for a graduate from the School of Agriculture. So he mentioned it to me, and I went and had an interview, and that's where I started, 1959. And I started in the barley selection part of the company, and that was the grain companies would receive samples of grain from the elevator agents all over the western Manitoba, shipped into, well, I'd say Manitoba and Saskatchewan. Alberta was kind of on its own at that time. And they were shipped into Winnipeg. And then the people in the offices here would bring them around to our office and to Canada Malting. And there was a couple other, K.A. Powell, I think, was selecting barley too. So they would show us the samples. And we would look at them for quality and plumpness and test them for protein and purity, like we needed to, it had to be the proper variety. And if it was acceptable, we would say okay, and we took a little sample of it and kept it. And then they would apply for a wheat board permit for one carload of barley based on that sample. And then later on during the year, we would, you know, bring the barley in as we required it in our plant. And when the car arrived, it was probed. And that probe was checked against that original sample way back when. And if they met, you know, they were equal, then we unloaded the car and paid for the barley.
I have a couple of questions based upon what you've just said, and one is, why can't all kinds of barley be used as malting barley?
Well, there's certain varieties, and the reason for that is that, well, later on we'll probably talk about the malting process, mm-hmm. There has to be a certain level of enzymes in the barley that interact with the starch of the barley and convert it to sugar. So you need certain varieties that are going to perform that process. And if you just use feed barley, you wouldn't. you wouldn't get as high an extract level, which is, extract is actually the amount of sugar you get. So you wouldn't get as high a extract level. The enzyme levels wouldn't be the right amount. So the malting varieties are bred specifically for malting. Yeah.
Other thing that you'd mentioned was you go and contract for the barley if you find a sample that seems to meet your needs, and then
yeah.
when it's actually delivered, you do the probe into the car and pull out a sample and hope it matches. Does it usually match?
Most of the time. Not always, no.
No?
Oh, no. There was sometimes we would refuse the car if the barley, you know, like sometimes maybe the sample was taken when the field was partially harvested, and then it rained or something in the meantime, and so when they got the full amount, it wasn't equal to the, we always allowed for a certain, variance, as long as the barley was what we call sound, that it was going to germinate properly, even if it was stained, you know, if it was bright color when we bought, selected it, but stained when we got it. As long as it was going to germinate, we would accept it.
Mm-hmm.
But and there was other things too, like if it was mixed, or if it was with other varieties, or if it was peeled and broken. Like sometimes during harvesting, if the combine wasn't set properly, the skin of the barley would be peeled off, and that's very important in the malting process to have, the husk on the barley.
Still there.
Yeah.
What was a typical day like in your job when you first started with the company?
In the morning was when all the grain companies came by with their samples. So, this took place mainly in the fall, while harvesting was taking place, that's when most of the samples come in. And so we would get, look at hundreds of samples in a day. But we'd look at most of them during the morning, usually, but some in the afternoon too. And then, you'd spend the afternoon, doing all the bookwork connected to those samples. And they were sent out to our plant and filed out there. So that was mainly the type of day it was. There were barley days held in Manitoba and Saskatchewan that we attended to promote the production of malting barley. So those things happened more during the winter. And we had to get the grades for the grain every day from the Board of Grain, the inspection department, and things like that.
What would you do with the grades? How does that fit into the process?
The barley, the final documents were based on the grade.
Okay.
It's been so long ago, I forget. 2CW and 3CW, for instance. Well, 2CW had a certain price, and 3CW had a different price. So the people in our office that were making out the outturns had to know the grades before they could process that.
Process the contract with the with the farmer.
Yeah.
Why would you have to promote growing of barley if there was a market for it? Why wasn't it just coming into you?
Well, it wasn't always, there was a fair amount of barley grown, but by the time you, not all of it's acceptable, and also a fair amount of malting barley is exported as barley. Like we were wanting it to bring it into our plant, make malt out of it, ship the malt to wherever. The grain companies or some of these other exporting companies would select the barley and ship it as barley. So if there was, say, 10 million tons of barley grown in Western Canada, there would only probably be 2 or 3 million that would be acceptable. The rest would have been, peeled and broken or weathered, mm-hmm. or whatever was wrong with it. So there had to be a large production for us to get the amount we needed. Yeah.
Was there a lot of competition in the
multi-market
then?
There was, I guess originally there was two malting companies, Dominion Malting, which I worked for, and Canada Malting. And then there was a company called K.A. Powell, who was an exporter of barley. And there was another company, too, that was exporting barley. And sometimes the grain companies did that on their own as well. So there was quite a lot of competition. And the problem was that if there was only a certain amount of barley available, acceptable quality, and the exporters got a hold of it before we did, then we would run short or had to take lower quality or, things like that. So it was a fairly competitive. Yeah.
Was it strictly price competition, or did you establish?
No, the price was set. The wheat board sets the price, mm-hmm. and the grade, the price, and depending on the grade, so that's all set. So it just depended. The grain companies, you wanted to make sure they came to see you. So we had to, you kind of promoted yourself with the grain companies, mm-hmm. too, so that they would make sure that they showed you the samples and not just took them to one place and not all the way around,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, actually, in 1961, there was a drought in Manitoba, so there was no barley available here. We, at the time, had a barley selector in Calgary, but there was a lot of barley grown in the Edmonton area and the Peace River district. So there was really no selection to be done in Manitoba, so I went to Edmonton for 6 or 8 weeks, and at that time there were grain companies in Edmonton, and so it was the reverse procedure there. I was just living in a motel, and so each morning I would go and visit each company and look at all their samples and select the ones we wanted, and so on. So that was kind of a nice, like, I was married and we had our first daughter, but she wasn't school age, so we all went and lived in a motel and had a wonderful time. Did all my work in about half a day, and so we saw lots of Edmonton and mm-hmm. the area around there.
So the one thing in doing a fair number of interviews now, it seems that it's the same with the malting industry, that relationships were a real big part of,
yes.
of establishing yourself in the business.
Yeah. And in this barley selection end of it, it was relationships were important, so that the suppliers of the barley would bring you the samples.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Before we move on in your career, I'd like to step back. You said at some point we should discuss what happens with the barley, how the and the malt and so on. So could you tell us a little bit
process.
About the malting process?
Sure. Well, when the cars arrive.
For those of you people who might be listening who have no idea even what malt is.
Yeah, well, malt is barley that's malt is barley that's germinated under controlled conditions, and you'll find out when I describe the process. So the barley comes into us and we unload it into our terminal in Transcona. It's put in bins according to variety. So then we store it. Actually, barley needs to be stored for a while after harvest in order for it to kind of complete its natural drying out process. So we never used it usually for maybe 6 weeks or so after we got it. So we always had to have a carryover from the previous year. Anyway, then you take one variety and put it through a set of cleaners. So the byproducts were taken out, like broken grain and wild oats and dust and all that sort of stuff were taken out. And then it was graded into two different sizes. And the reason for that is so that you'd have a batch of barley that was, the kernels were all the same size, so that when you germinate it, you have a better chance of them germinating at the same rate, which is very important. Anyway, when you have the barley cleaned and sized, then you take one size and put it into steep tanks where it's soaked for probably about 35 to 40 hours.
Like steeping tea?
Same idea, except it's not kept under water the whole time. Like when you put barley in water, the first 10 hours, it takes up water from whatever it is barley, say 12% moisture. In the first 10 hours, it would go up to about 35%. Then you'd drain it off, let it sit for a while, and bring more barley, more water in. And you'd do that about three times. And increase the moisture from 12% up to about 42 to 44%.
And why is it necessary to drain it off? Why doesn't it just...
Well, it would become waterlogged.
Okay.
Yeah. So you kind of needs oxygen. And at the end of the steeping time, the moisture level is approximately 42 to 44%, and the grain has actually started to germinate. Like you could see little white tips on the end of each kernel. Then you transfer it into a germination compartment or drums, like we had drums for many years, changed it later on to compartments, but they're just big, huge drums that have sections in them. This here, and the air is brought in, and these travel from one end of the drum to the other like this.
Mm-hmm.
So the air is brought in here. As it's going through the drum, it's drawn to the center, drum, through the barley, and that controls the temperature. In a bed, you just have it's just a box, has a perforated floor. And you have barley in about this depth, and you have air coming up from the bottom. Fans blowing air up. So you can control the amount of air you want, or less air, or whatever.
Was the drum preferable to the beds, or?
Not really, I don't think. It was just a different method. Like this was called a gallon henning drum. And this was called a salad and box, and that was the companies that sold them. Yeah.
Where were they made?
Some of them were made in Winnipeg. The drums were made in Winnipeg by Dominion Bridge, I think it is. Was, yeah. So anyway, then the barley, after it's steeped, it's dumped into a box like this, and germinated for 4 days. And if this is a kernel of barley here, the same thing happens in the malting process as if when you put a kernel of grain in the ground. It absorbs the moisture. The steep tank does the moisture absorption part. During that time, it grows roots, and it grows... coleoptile, I think it's called. Anyway, this here, it grows up underneath the husk, and in the ground, that keeps going and becomes a plant.
Almost like an onion. just looking at the diagram that you've got here, would be like putting a little onion in the ground, and you have the roots coming up, and then the whitish part in the center that comes up.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. But what in the malting process, we stop the growth when the coleoptile is 3/4 the length of the kernel.
Before it emerges from the husk.
Before it emerges from the husk. And that's why the husk is important when you buy barley, because it protects this little plant. And it's also important why the kernels are the same size, so that they all germinate at the same rate. While all this is happening, there's enzymes being activated, and the enzymes attack the starch and convert some of it to sugar. Some of that sugar is a source of energy for growth, but some of the starch is converted to sugar. There's also other enzymes that attack the protein of the barley and convert it from insoluble form to soluble form. So during that 4 days, you want to grow the barley at a certain rate, so it'll arrive at this stage after 4 days. You don't want to grow it too much, because then you're using up sugar that the brewery wants. So that's why it's important that everything is, the temperature is controlled and the humidity is controlled, so that everything grows nicely at the same rate. And it usually does if you have good barley. If you don't have as good a quality barley, then you get uneven growth, and then it gives you, the malt isn't as good a quality. Anyway, at the end of germination, then this the malt, green malt they call it, is transferred to a kiln, which is another big box, and it's laying in here, and there's heat applied from the bottom, and there's a machine there's also a machine here too, that has little turners on it, and it travels up and down and mixes it up.
Up and down the box.
Up and down the box, yeah. And the drum turns, and it does the same thing as what these machines do. The same thing in the kiln. The machines go up and down, maybe during a 24-hour period, they may make 2 trips. And it loosens up the grain so that the air goes through more evenly.
Mm-hmm. How big would these be? Like, we're talking about huge?
They were, what size were they? This would probably be about 100 tons.
The box would hold 100
tons. 100 tons, yeah. So a 100-ton batch.
So if we're looking at the size of this kitchen, which is about 12 by 20?
Yeah, it would be.
Bigger than that?
Yeah, they'd probably be 20 feet wide and 80 or 90 feet long, something like that. Yeah. So then, and what the kilning does is it dries the malt. Like the moisture, it also in here is maintained at 44%, same as when it came from the steep tank. But then in the kilning process, you drive off the moisture and dry it down to 4%. And the reason for that is so that it becomes stable, because it's going to have to be stored for a while, and you don't want anything with any higher moisture in a bin for any length of time.
So you still have the little kernel. It's still
the
main thing.
Rootlets.
There's no liquid coming out yet. We're still...
Oh, yeah, still a kernel.
Okay.
Still a kernel. And with the roots on.
Okay.
And the roots go with it over here.
Okay.
What happens to the roots in the kiln?
They dry up.
But they stay attached.
They travel with the kernel, yeah.
Okay.
And also what happens during kilning is that the... what do you call that? The moisture and the protein, the sugars and the protein and the moisture all go together to form what's called melanoidins. And melanoidins are color bodies, so that the malt takes on a certain color. And that color then follows right through to the beer. So, and the brewery, you know, they have their specifications and they don't want too high a color or too low a color or whatever. So that's what happens, this process of forming color bodies and reducing the moisture is the purpose of the kilning. So that's finished malt. It's taken back to the bin, to a bin for storage. And that's just one size of one variety. So a variety we had, for instance, was Harrington. And this would be Harrington 6. Well, then we had Harrington 5, which was a different size. And it would be malted separately and put in a bin separately. And then we might have Metcalf was another variety. And it was 6 and 5. And it would be malted separately. Then when the when we ship the malt, we take a certain percentage of Harrington 6 and Medcalf 5 and something else 6 and blend it together and put it over a cleaner, and the cleaner takes off the roots here. So then the malt is still in kernel form, but it's blended and loaded into a boxcar or a hopper car and sent to a brewery. When the brewery get it, they put it through a, it's not really a grinder, it's kind of a, just a press, because the malt, the kernel looks like a barley kernel, only it's white because it's been kind of bleached during the drying. But it's very friable. It's like a biscuit. You know, if you bite it, it's a little bit sweet because there's still sugar in there. But it crumbles up easily. So you got to handle malt very carefully, or it's, you know, to protect this husk again, because the brewery wants the husk too. And what they do is they grind it up so that the crushes it, you know, into little pieces, all the kernel, husk and everything. The husk kind of pops off. And then they put it into a mash tub and, you know, at a certain temperature, and then raise the temperature. And the enzymes that were developed in the malting process, the protein enzymes and the starch enzymes, and what happens also, just to go back here, the enzyme activity stops when you dry it.
In the kiln.
Then, yeah. And you got to dry it at a certain temperature so you don't kill off too many enzymes. So then when the brewery get it and crush it and put it in here at a certain temperature, the enzymes become active again. And the conversion of starch to sugar that we started is complete. So they end up with a big tub of crushed up malt, and the husks are in there, but the inside part has been, the starch has been converted to sugar, and it dissolves in the water, so you have a big sugar solution mixed with husk. So they take that and they transfer it into what's called a lauter tub, and that and the husks filter to the bottom of the tub. You know, it's a big tub like this. The husks filter to the bottom, and the liquid filters through. So the husks are important. You know, if they're all broken up, then this becomes packed more, so the liquid won't go through as fast, so it's slower runoff time, and that's no-no in breweries, because time is a big important thing, you know, to get a brew through in so many hours. So
What happens if the brew is slowed down because, as you mentioned, there's been something gone wrong with the quality of the husks? What happens to the quality of the beer with a slow passing through this system?
Probably what they also have some mechanism to put it through again. You know, they can pump it through again if the runoff is too slow. But the usually what happens is that they don't get as much extract. An extract is what they, because the more extract, the more beer you get out of a given amount of malt. So they're, that's a very important feature of malt, that it's going to run off properly and give you the most extract that you can get. So then what you get down here is a product called wort. And it looks like beer, like it's the color of beer, but it's just a sugar solution.
And that's the product that's come through the husks.
That's the product, but it's all liquid now.
Mm-hmm.
So then what they do is and this is all done with pipelines and so on. So there's a pipeline coming out of here. Over here, there's a yeast room that has the pipes coming out. So this pipe is going here and here, and this comes in here. So the wort goes out and the yeast comes in, and they send it out to a fermenter. And it's the yeast and the wort ferment. Sorry, I missed a part here. They put it through they heat it up anyway. They heat the wort and boil it.
Wort.
And that gets rid of some of the proteins. And they also, that's where they add hops. It gives bitterness to the beer. And it depends on the type of hop that they had. And they select certain varieties to give you certain flavors.
And what are hops?
Hops are, they're like vines. Mm. They grow on big fences. And they're like big cabbage leaves with little wee seeds in the middle. And the little wee seeds are what gives you the bitterness. And, when I was still working, or initially when we started, they would harvest them in like bales of hay. You know, the little square bales of hay about this big. That's how the brewery would get hops in bales. And then they'd, throw them into the boiling vat. And the little seeds are the things that, well, then later on, they had hop pellets. So that was much easier to handle. Now they have hop extract. So it's just they have a barrel and it comes out in a pipe and fed in.
Along with the yeast, so it would be.
Yeah, so it's the same idea. It's just an easier way of handling mm-hmm. it.
Are hops produced in Canada?
Yeah. There's Chilliwack, they grow hops. But a lot of them come from the United States around Yakima, which is in Washington. Yeah. Also, there's European hops too.
And what, they can't be grown on the prairies?
Sure. No. Well, I don't know, I have them in my yard.
Hops, do you?
I use them to cover my arbors. They grow so fast.
Is that right?
It's just the fastest thing you can grow, and it comes back every year. It doesn't matter what happens to it. It's like a weed.
Well, yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, it's not a commercial crop, but it certainly grows.
Yeah.
You can buy them at the Betty Oates stores.
Yeah.
Betty plant stores, yeah.
I guess it depends on the various
types.
I never
thought they could be grown here.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So.
So then they, just to finish this
mm-hmm.
off, you know, the wort, after the boiling is finished, then it's cooled down, and then it's sent out to the fermenter, and the yeast is added in. So then they have big, big fermenters with yeast and wort, and the fermentation takes place, and the wort is converted to, the sugar is converted to alcohol, and it's about a 7-day process. And what happens is when the alcohol gets to a certain level, the yeast settles to the bottom. So then when the fermentation is finished, they pump the liquid off, leave this in the bottom, take it out, put it into big tubs, and the yeast is used over and over again. Yeah. Because it reproduces itself.
It's a living organism.
Living organism, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so then after fermentation, it goes into storage and stays in storage for 7 days or so. And then after that, it's put through filters before it's bottled.
So why doesn't all beer taste the same?
Well, it's mainly the hops. It gives it a different flavor. And different breweries, you know, decide what kind of flavor they want and get the hops that give them that. Like they would use more than one hop, you know, in one.
Just like the various varieties of barley, which would have some different properties.
Yeah.
And so the hops would be the same thing, different varieties would have different properties.
Different properties, yeah. Like European hops would give you a different flavor than a Chilliwack hop or a Yakima hop.
Mm.
Yeah.
When you go through this process, both with the, at the, at Dominion, at the malting place, and then come to the brewery,
mm-hmm.
There seems to be a lot of technical expertise and even just a sense that a person has to have in order to make things happen the way it's supposed to happen.
Yeah. Like a lot of brewers would be chemists or microbiologists would be their background. And maltsters would be mostly, graduates of agriculture. Specializing in plant breeding and plant physiology and that kind of stuff.
As it's something you learn on the job then? The fine tuning of it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, you can understand, this is a very complicated process.
The process of sprouting.
All what happens inside a kernel is very complicated. And, a lot of chemistry is, you need to have some chemistry knowledge in order to understand it all. Yeah.
So we sort of left your career when you started.
Yeah. I started as the barley selection in 1959 and did that until 1964. And then in 64, the plant superintendent at the plant retired, so his assistant took over his job, and I went to the plant to be involved in the production rather than the selection. So I started as an assistant maltster, and then became a maltster, and then became a plant manager, then became vice president of production when I retired. That's what I was doing. But all at this same plant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How would you describe the difference between what you knew the day you started being in charge of production and when you left that job? So
you mean when I retired?
No, when you moved on into the other aspects of your career, but you said you became a maltster.
Yeah.
So when you went from selection,
yeah.
What did you learn?
Well, when I was doing the selection part of it, the idea was that I was going to go out to the plant eventually. So when I wasn't busy in the downtown office, like we had an office in the Grain Exchange building and the plants in Transcona. So I would go out there for an afternoon and, go through the malting process. And I wrote a paper on it. So by the time I was ready to go out there, I had a good idea on the malting process on paper, but not exactly how it, you know, how it works practically. And then when I did make that change, at the time we had a plant in Toronto and a plant in Buffalo. So I went to Toronto for 6 weeks, two different times, to work down there and get an idea of how that plant operated. Because the idea was, you know, if there ever needed to be, you know, somebody change plants for whatever reason, you need to be familiar with, you know, what they, how their operation worked. And then in Ontario, in Toronto, it was like the malting process itself was the same. They had drums there, but their barley selection was different. They got some barley from Ontario, or then they would buy barley through the Lakehead. You know, the grain companies would ship barley to their, and store it in their terminals, and then ship it by boat to Toronto. And they'd get boat loads of barley from Western Canada. And that's how they got their barley supply.
Now, Dominion Malting, where was their operation in Ontario? Was that on the harbour front in Toronto?
Yeah, it was
Toronto?
On Lakeshore Boulevard, Parliament Street and Lakeshore Boulevard.
A large elevator there.
Yeah, they had an elevator and a malting plant. Yeah.
Okay.
And Canada Malting had a plant there too, and just down the ways of it. Yeah. So then in 1964 I moved out there, and like to become a maltster you need to know the malting process, but at the time there were 70 employees working at the plant out there, so you know, not all of them were in the, like there was a malting division and an elevator division, and we had a foreman in each one. So you can't, you had to be a manager as well as a maltster. And so that, that, you know, you kind of learn that on the job and take a few courses if you can, you know, on human relations and all the rest of it. So that, so I stayed there till 1997.
When that's, you retired.
That's when I retired, yeah. 38 years.
Yeah. That's amazing. That's, I know I'm not supposed to talk, but
no, that's
go.
Fine.
That,
we loosen up considerably now that we're moving into the,
the
project.
It's interesting that many of the people that we've interviewed, and we've commented on this, that very few people now can have a 35, 36, 37 year career in one place.
No.
And do a variety of jobs within the company.
Yeah.
And it seems like that.
Yeah, it doesn't work
too.
That way now. And the, like the thing is, there wasn't, at the time, there was only two malting companies in Canada. So when you were a maltster, you were one of few people. Now there's four, but you know, even at that, there isn't a lot of opportunities for to go anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And was Dominion's headquarters in Winnipeg? Is it a, was it a Winnipeg company or was it a?
Yes, there. Well, originally it was owned by Canadian Breweries. And I don't know if you ever heard of E.P. Taylor.
Sure.
Yeah.
The horses.
Yeah, the horses, yeah. Well, he owned many, many breweries, and he called them all Canadian Breweries. Well, in 1928, Dominion Malting, that was the first, that's when Dominion Malting started. And it, some people from the States came up and rented the CNR elevator in Transcona and built a malt house beside it. Then in 1946, when E.P. Taylor had all these breweries, he was getting kind of anxious that he wanted a kind of a reliable malting supply. So he built this plant here, the second plant here, in 46 and also built the one in Toronto in 46. And then I guess it operated that way. In 1960, there was new bins added, like another annex was added here. And 1972, there was another plant added. So there was, that's the third plant. And then in 1992, the third plant was expanded. So it went from about 70,000 tons and ended up at about 94,000 tons production is what its capacity is now. Yeah.
And did E.P. Taylor own this company during the whole time?
No, he owned it up until 1968, and then he sold all the malting companies that he owned. And at that time, there was a fellow who was president of Carling's, and he bought Dominion Malting. He bought this plant here. And the one in Toronto was sold to Canada Malting, and the one in Buffalo was sold to Fleischmann Malting in the States. So Dominion Malting from 68 on was privately owned until 1977, when his name was George Black. When he died, his sons inherited it, and one of his sons is Conrad Black. You've heard of Conrad Black. So from 77 till about 1985, it was Conrad and his brother and two other guys that owned it, operated it. And then it was sold in 85 to ADM, which is a big food processing plant in the States, Archer Daniel Midland. And they owned it till about 1990, I think I wrote this down, but I don't always remember all this stuff. Yeah, in 2000 it was sold to LaSave Malting Company. So ADM and LaSave, which is a French malting company, they owned it in partnership, although LaSave had the most shares. And then in 2007, it was sold to Malt Europe, and that's who owns it now. Hmm. Company from Europe. They own many malting companies in all around Europe, in Australia, and China. So it's a big corporation.
I'm surprised that breweries haven't made sure that they have like almost a vertical kind of.
Yeah.
Of ownership all the way up, and yet they're not.
Well, they did with in Taylor's time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had a guaranteed supply of malt.
Right, yeah.
But since that time, like Labatt's didn't own any. Like the breweries themselves didn't own any. Molson's didn't own any malting plants.
Right.
In Europe, and it's quite common to have a malt house and a brewery side by side. Yeah. And China too.
I'm surprised.
With all of the changes in ownership, did that have any impact? Did every change of ownership have an impact on your work, or did it pretty much stay the same?
No, it didn't make too much. Like there was, you know, some policy changes, but you know, we just kept making malt and
kept doing what you did well.
You know, I don't think our customers even changed as a result of the ownership. When ADM had the had part ownership is when we did a fair amount of expansion and automation. So we used a lot of their expertise as far as engineers and people like that.
You talked about customers. At the time that there was Canada Malting and Dominion Malting, how did the customers decide who to use?
Well, some of it was just due to freight rates. Like when you're in this location, it was much more profitable to ship east than west. So we brought the barley in from the west, but we very seldom ever ship malt back. We ship to Regina and Saskatoon, but not into Alberta or BC, just because of the freight rates. And the reason for that was the Crow's Nest Pass rate was based on Thunder Bay. So a farmer, when he shipped a carload of barley, he paid the freight rate to Thunder Bay. Winnipeg is here, and this is where the farmer is. So the barley would come here, we would pay a stop-off charge to bring it into our plant, but the freight that was actually paid from Winnipeg to Thunder Bay was not used. So what we were able to do is when we ship malt, we could ship a carload of malt from Winnipeg to Thunder Bay and use that freight. And then beyond that had to be paid. So it was beneficial for us to ship malt east. So as a result, our customers were, like when Canadian Breweries owned it, we shipped to various places, even though the freight rate, like we shipped to the States, and because he had breweries down in the States too. But after that, you know, we shipped to Montreal was a big customer of Carling's in Montreal, Moosehead in New Brunswick, or other big customers down there. Like we shipped to Montreal, Quebec City, Toronto. So, and those were big breweries, so it took, you know, most of our production. But, you know, we had to work hard to maintain the quality and provide, you know, expertise to the breweries on if there was any problems, you know, to explain it to them and try and correct it. And so we visited breweries regularly to make sure that the malt was performing properly and so on. So that was, you know, like my job kind of changed over the years. Like I was, initially I was right in the plant every day, you know, checking the malt and making schedules and, you know, supervising men and all the rest of it. Well, then as time went on, I would, you know, spend more time with public relations part of the end of it.
Sales and promotion.
Yeah, yeah. And as a result of that, we were fortunate to, there's a Master Brewers Association of the Americas. And it's an association of all North America and the Caribbean and Mexico. So every year there was an international convention. So we went to those conventions every year. And Muriel was able to come along. And quite often we'd stay and travel somewhere. And I remember one time we went to Philadelphia. And after the convention over, we took a train to New York for a couple of days. Saw a few plays, and so, you know, there was some benefits.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
And also, like I said, we didn't ship west, but we, I guess there was a special, yeah, there was a special export rate, freight rate, out of the west coast. So we went to Japan and got some customers over there. So we ship malt to Japan. And every year we had to go to Japan and we make up a little booklet of all the new varieties that are coming out and what the crop was going to be like for the coming year and what they could expect and all the rest of it. So we'd go to their head offices and give this presentation. And then after we were done, they would tell us how our malt performed over the past year, and they rated you, you know, number one, number two, number three. So it was kind of interesting to.
You've been to Japan.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Quite a few times, yeah.
So where would Canadian malt find itself besides the States, Japan, and in Canada?
South America.
South America.
Mexico. I think now there's maybe a little bit going to South Africa. But the malting plants that, like, there was only two to begin with, but now there's four. And Dominion Malting is mostly Canadian and Mexico at the moment. Canada Malting, I think, still shipped to Japan, plus Canada, and maybe a little bit to the States.
With the European ownership now, have you... do you sort of keep your tentacles in and know, are they now shipping then more to Europe?
No.
No?
No, there'd be no malt shipped from here to Europe.
Why would that be?
Well, it's just, they grow their own barley and have their own malt houses and so on. Same with Australia and China.
Mm-hmm.
There's no malt shipped to either of those places. There's barley shipped to China, lots of malting barley from Canada. And they have their own malt houses, fairly new modern malt houses. Like they used to have small malt houses and many, many of them, a brewery and a malt house all over the place. Well, those are gradually disappearing, and they have big, huge tower malting plants. But they use mostly import the barley.
We were talking a lot about the larger beer companies. What about the microbreweries? How do they fit into the scheme of things? They buy a little mini vat of malt?
Yeah. Yeah, just small amounts. Yeah, you just ship them smaller amounts. One thing they do, though, is they produce kind of specialty beers, and they're different flavors. There's different kinds of malt. Like what we made was just normal brewer's malt, what would it be called? But there's caramel malt and chocolate malt and black barley.
What about wheat beer? What would it be?
Well, there's wheat is malted as well. It's not as easy because it doesn't have a husk on it. So the, you know, this little sprout that grows up breaks off and it kind of mats all together. So it's difficult to malt. But it's only used as a small percentage. When wheat beer is made, it's not all wheat malt. It's, you know, barley malt and wheat malt. But the I was going to say about the specialty breweries, they use this different kind of malt. Like they use normal malt, but they add in chocolate malt or caramel malt, or, you know, to give different flavors. Yeah. And the mainline breweries, the big breweries, would use a bit of caramel malt for coloring. To adjust the color of the beer.
Mm-hmm.
Like if the malt gives you a certain color, but if they want some, like now they make, what do they call it? Rickers Red, for instance, is a beer. Well, it's fairly dark color, so they would add caramel malt to that to get that dark color, yeah.
Would you, in tasting various beers, be able to be so fine-tuned that you would be able to recognize the origin of the barley?
No. Like brewers, brewers actually taste beer every day. You know, they have a taste panel, and they part of the some of the samples are their own production that's made that day. Some of them are competitors' beer, and they can usually, or I mean, they can tell pretty well their own beer for sure. But what they're looking for is, anything that's different that shows up in their own production every day.
Because they're looking for consistency.
Consistency, yeah.
I'm just going to refer back to some of the questions on the sheet here so we don't miss any areas. But you've discussed a number of them in just your discussion of how the system works. Looking at connections between the malting industry and other players in the grain industry, is there anything that you wanted to add about your connection with the producers of the barley?
Well, as I say, we had these barley days in order to educate the malting barley growers as to the malting process and what's important to us so that they can do something on their end so they don't peel the barley, or they don't that it has to be a certain quality, and why that's so, and so that was done. But there's a institute, like a brewing and malting barley research institute. And it's financed by the brewing and malting companies. And their mandate for many years was to test new varieties. Like plant breeders are developing new varieties all the time. The institute kind of coordinates the plant breeders and the grain commission and the malting and brewing companies, kind of brings them together so that everybody knows what everybody else wants. We used to use six-row barley for many years. Well, then...
Six-row barley means?
Six-row barley means that it has six rows.
Seeds on the head? Okay.
On the head, it has three like that, and three on the other side of the stem. Two-row barley has two kernels, and the third one has only one kernel, I should say, and the two outside ones are sterile. So it only has two rows. But it produces more kernels, and the yield of two-row barley is greater than six-row. And it's usually a bigger kernel, and these kernels are curved, and
the six-row ones.
The six-row one, and these are straight, so it actually malts better. The malting companies were saying, we'd like to have a barley that a two-row barley, but the enzyme levels of two-row barleys were too low for many years. So the plant breeders worked away at that, and now we use two-row barley all the time, and the enzyme levels are up where it's required. So the plant breeders can do a lot if they know what's required, and takes them a while to do it, like 8-9 years, but eventually they come up with a variety that's an improvement on the previous ones. So this Brewing and Malting Barley Research Institute, part of their work is to coordinate all those people so that everybody knows what everybody else wants. They also had a little small brewery, so they test the grain commission actually had a malt house, and they would malt these little samples, like the plant breeder samples. They would malt them, and then the brewery would brew them. Hi.
Hi.
Meet Nancy and
Bee.
Hello.
This is Muriel.
Hi.
Muriel Kenyon has just joined us. We're taping here, so you are now part of history.
Oh. Well, thank you. I'll just sneak on through. I was at a soccer game. I'm half frozen.
Oh.
Oh, dear. It's windy.
Yeah, so the Brewing and Malting Barley Research Institute would brew them, and that would give them an idea whether there's any potential there or not. If there was, they would be, the research stations would increase the volume the next year, and then the malting companies had pilot malting houses, so we would pilot malt these things, and determine whether they're, and the breweries had pilot breweries. So it went through the whole step by step, and then eventually, if the purity was good and the quality was good and disease resistance was good and all the rest of it, and the malting and the brewing was satisfactory, then the barley, the variety would be accepted as a acceptable variety.
And then there would be the promotion of it to the farmers to grow it.
Yeah, promotion of the farmers to grow. Actually, that was another step. After the pilot brewing, then it was grown on, a few farmers would grow, a few fields of it to get a few car lots. And then we would malt, a couple of car lots, and Canada Malting would malt a couple of car lots before the final acceptance.
Mm. Who usually finance the whole sort of research test operation?
Well, this Brewing and Malting Barley Research Institute is financed by the malting and brewing companies. And the grain research laboratory is the federal government. It was their input into supporting new varieties.
And are they like wheat, the new varieties, that they also had to be visually, you were able to know what you were getting by looking at it visually?
Yeah. Well, when I was selecting barley, you had to, be able to identify the variety. If it was mixed or whatever, you had to spot that, mm-hmm. or you're in trouble if you accepted it and it was...
It looked good, but it wasn't.
Non-malting variety, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Were there ever situations where barley kernels slipped in that were not up to grade? Because they looked good?
That were a different variety?
Yes, yeah.
Yes, we would get mixtures. And, if we didn't catch it, then we were, it was our problem. But normally you were able to identify them. There were things on the kernels that you could use to identify them, like the awns, for instance, on the barley kernel. Certain varieties had rough awns and others had smooth, like all two row had smooth awns.
What are awns?
Well, like a barley head, has these things coming
right
out the top.
Mm-hmm.
This is all the kernels here.
Okay.
Like when you see
yes.
a field of barley, and then the
hairs, sort of.
The hairs, yeah, yeah. Well, that was one identifying thing. And, you could tell six row from two row just by straight kernels or curved kernels,
mm-hmm.
So there was easy markers. And then there was, on a kernel at the bottom here, they had a rickilla. They had a little rickilla here, they called it, and it had hairs on it. Well, some varieties had hairy rickillas, and others had non-hairy.
Bald ones?
Bald ones, yeah. So you had those kinds of things to identify. varieties. Just one other thing that with this Brewing and Malting Institute. It's still operating now, but there's another institute called the Canadian Malting Barley Technical Center. And like the institute doesn't have a brewery anymore. And this technical center has a malting plant and a brewery. And they're based in the Canadian Grain Commission building downtown. You know, are you familiar with that building?
Oh,
with
sure.
The mushroom top?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's where they're based. And what they do is they actually promote malting barley around the world. Like they go to China and they go here and give seminars. But they also, all the malting barley that's exported out of Canada, by boat loads, they get samples of the boat loads and they make malt out of it and they make beer out of it. And so when the barley gets to the destination and the customer is saying, well, this is something wrong, then they know exactly what kind of malt it's going to make and what kind of beer it's going to make. And they can give that information to the customer. And so it's financed by grain companies and malting companies, and the wheat board is a big player in that.
So very similar to what they found successful with marketing wheat then, that they would test out the various wheats on products that were made in the various countries, like pita or pasta,
and
then be able to do some troubleshooting if the customer was having difficulty.
The other thing that's in Winnipeg is the Canadian Grains Institute, and that's what they do, is bring people over here and show them how to make pasta out of our varieties and flour. And like there's a flour mill there and a pasta mill and all the rest of it. And these people too do that. Or are these the
Malting Barley Technical Center.
Yeah, the person that runs that, he would be involved in like the grains. The Canadian Grains Institute have malting and brewing courses as well and bring groups into Canada.
Do you know who runs this? Do you know the person's name?
Yeah, his name is Rob McCaig. I think it's M-C-C-A-I-G. McCaig.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Rob. Yeah. He was a brewer with Molson's for many years, and then when this institute started, he's taken over that job, so he's familiar with brewing, which, you know, they operate a small brewery, and, you know, has become familiar with malting and barley and whatever.
Connection with the Canadian Grain Commission, you mentioned a little bit about contacting them for the grades and so on. Were there any other connections with the inspection, weighing?
Initially, doesn't happen now, but initially there was a government employee checking the weights of the barley coming in. Like as the carloads were unloaded, we had our own employee weighing it, but a government employee had to check the weight and, you know, write out a ticket or whatever. And initially, many years ago, we had an employee, government employee, checking the weights of the malt out. But after a few years, that didn't seem necessary. But it wasn't, and now grain companies accept our weights, except we have to prove that we get our scales checked every year so that the, you know, the weights are proper.
By the weighing division of the Grain Commission.
By the weighing division of the Grain Commission, yeah. So, you know, like even, I'm not sure how the inspection takes place now, but it's changed quite a bit. Like each car lot used to be inspected and graded.
And what about the elevator facilities themselves? Are they also inspected?
For weights, you mean?
As you would, let's say, a Cargill elevator, inspecting for inventory and things such as that, or that's you're operating outside the that system.
Nothing to do.
Yeah.
But what happens now is, you know, this selection process that I described, that's the way that barley used to be selected. Now, what happens is that the grain companies, with these big elevators that they have cleaning facilities in the elevators, and the grain is is purchased differently now. Like the farmer can haul his grain to the elevator, and the elevator agent can buy it on the spot. And what they do, like their agents have been trained, so that they now, you know, bin Harrington barley in this bin and Metcalf barley in this bin, and check the protein levels. And so what happens is now Dominion Malting gets a unit train of 25 cars from one elevator. So it's all, you know, pre-determined. You make a contract for 25 cars and they supply it. And then you pay them. So there's no inspection, there's no weighing. Well, there's weighing when we, you know, but...
Unloaded, but you're confident of the load is what it was intended to be.
But they
they're guaranteeing that the farmer has delivered, where before you had to check the car load to be sure that you were getting what you asked for. Yeah.
The grain company is doing all that work now.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a selection department anymore, like we used to. Yeah.
What other changes have occurred? Major changes occurred over the time of your career. You talked about the, you know, the certainly the change of ownership, the people in and out of the business. Any other?
Well, certainly all the weighing part of it and the inspection part of it is all different. The malting part is pretty much the same.
Has the automation affected the numbers of employees?
Oh, yes. Yeah, like originally we had 70 employees, but you know, at that time we shipped malt in boxcars, and you know, there was a lot more manual labor required. I think at the moment there's probably about 25 employees, and that's due to automation. You know, the grain is, it's all computerized, and the grain in the terminal in the elevator part of the plant is brought over automatically into the steep tanks, and the water is drained and filled by a computer. The temperature that's applied to the germination is all by computer. Same with kilning. So it's very different that way, the automation for sure. Quite different.
But the products have essentially remained the same.
But the product is about the same, yeah.
What would you say your major challenges were over your career?
The challenge every year was the barley. Like, you don't always get good quality barley. And so then you have to make adjustments to the process in order to get the maximum extract and potential out of what you got to work with. And sometimes it's a big challenge, if grain, if barley is, badly weathered, and sometimes it's been even sprouted, and you can't determine that. you know, then when it, when you get it, to put it through the process, it doesn't always sprout again. Or if it does, it's very uneven growth. So you get poor malting results. So that was always a big challenge every year. But like, not every year, if the barley crop was good, it was, you know, a nice change. But
are there some special, what leads to a good barley crop? What kind of weather and soil conditions leads to sort of optimal?
Well, it's grown, it grows best in sandy, loamy soil. And it doesn't like too hot of weather. You know, it needs rain at the right time and all the rest of it. But like it's a moderate temperature type of a cereal. So that's why it grows so well in Western Canada.
Are there regions of Western Canada that are noted
yes.
for their barley production?
Yeah. Oh, yes. The Touro barley that's grown now, I would say north of number one highway and west of Saskatoon. That corner of Saskatchewan produces lots and lots of malting barley, Touro malting barley. And in Alberta, southern Alberta, has more malting barley than, well, central Alberta has some too, but. And Manitoba, there's I guess it's more of the southern part that grows most of the better type of malting barley in Manitoba. Although it's funny, when I first started, we used to get a lot of barley from, if you went from Brandon to Russell, you know, kind of that up by Sandy Lake area and so on. There was a lot of barley growing there, but not as much nowadays, whether farmers are going into different crops likely and stuff like that. Like the barley production is going down too because of other crops, you know. Like for years, wheat was always the number one crop and barley was always number two. But then about late 80s, I'd say,
Canola
came in, and I would say it's number two now for sure, and barley would be number three. I don't think there'd be anything else, but you know, there's peas and lentils and, you know, all those specialty crops coming in as well.
Would there be that shift? Is canola easier to grow? Are the markets better? The price better?
Probably the price is better. The markets are better. Like malting barley is a risky business. Like, you know, you seed the right variety, and hopefully the weather or the growing season is acceptable. And you get a nice crop of barley, and then you swath it, and it rains for 4 days. You know, it's quite risky.
And then it's downgraded to feed barley.
Well, can be if it's bad enough. Yeah. So.
Are there any?
But just one thing about that. Years ago, when there was tighter quotas. The malting barley was, and there was a premium paid for barley, malting barley as well, but you could ship a carload of barley over and above your quota, so it didn't affect the other quota that was, you know, that you were given by the government.
By the wheat board.
Or by the wheat board, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that was the farmer's quota.
Yeah. So it was quite an advantage if you could get a carload of barley. It was a nice sum of money, and there was a premium paid. And and it was in its own separate pool. So at the end of the year, you know, you if there was a good sale of barley, export and to the maltsters, then the final payment was pretty good. You know.
Couple of questions here, and I think you've probably answered them. What are the most vivid memories about your work life?
We had a couple of fires.
Oh.
Yeah, we had one night, like we had the kilning process is the fuel is natural gas, but we had standby propane unit because the when it got very cold, the gas company would cut us off and we had to use propane for our kilning and so on.
They would cut you off because they needed the product for houses and
right. So one night there was the propane place. Some of the pipes, I guess over a period of time, the pipes, the propane ate holes in the tubes that were coming out of this machine. So we had one room with a heater in it, like a boiler, and another room with this converter that converted the natural gas to propane, or converted the liquid propane to gas. But there was about this much space between the rooms. So I guess, you know, these pipes were leaking a little bit and the security guard was going out to check and he opened the door and that, you know, the draft, came in and it, the fumes came down and the boiler, you know, the flames of the boiler set it on fire and poof. So that was an exciting night.
Lots of damage?
A fair amount of damage. The other thing is you could go back on natural gas, but you paid a premium penalty. So we weren't shut down or anything, but... And there was another one time when a Honeywell operator was installing some equipment for us, and he was drilling holes through a wall from one area to another. And the malting plant is under negative pressure all the time because the fans are up at the top and they're sucking air in the bottom, it's getting heated up and it goes through a kiln. So it's, you know, you have to have double doors to go into the plant because of all the suction all the time. So he was just drilling a little hole like this. And
about an inch.
Yeah, but he was soldering the line right at the hole. So it just sucked the flame right in and the wall was insulated. So it started to burn in between the walls. So that was an interesting day, long day, before everything was kind of, you know, we were sure that, like we had to shut everything down to get rid of all this suction pressure. And then, you know, like a malting plant is a 24-hour operation, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. So any delay in anything, you're behind, and it affects the process and affects the quality.
Was it a relatively safe place to work?
Yes, I would say that the malting plant is under federal jurisdiction, so the Department of Labor, you know, came around and checked quite often, and you know, we had to put in noise control and pollution control. We when you're kilning malt and the air is going out the roof, some of this, these little rootlets, you know, that are little fine dust that go along with the air. And there was two or three people that lived across from the plant had swimming pools. So they complained bitterly about the dust. And then we had to put in dust control for the, you know, the workers themselves, because the elevator was a very dusty place with all the machines going. And, oops. So, you know, there was rules and regulations put in by the Department of Labor that we had to follow. And so we did have one major accident, and I don't know how it could have been,
averted.
Averted, but there was a group of people working on a leg, and I don't know if you're familiar with the leg, but it
leg of the elevator.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, it has a belt and buckets and so on, and they were working on this anyway, and it was. It was kind of when we were converting to automation and so on. Anyway, you know, we had to go through all these lockout procedures and so on, and so that the leg couldn't be started when these guys were working on it. And I just forget all the details now. But anyway, the leg got started, and one guy got his leg got pulled up, and it was. I think, you know, it was above the knee or below the knee. It was had to be removed. So that was a really serious incident. And of course, we after that had to put in. We had to really, you know, be sure of our regulations were being implemented as far as lockout procedures and so on. But
over a 37-year career, that's a pretty decent safety record for the operation.
Yeah, there was the normal back problems and stuff like that, but nothing major other than that one incident.
One of the reasons that we're doing this project, obviously, is to... preserve the history of the industry. If there were a center set up for the public to learn and experience the history of the malting industry, what do you think would be the most important pieces that you think should be preserved in that kind of museum activity center?
You mean as far as a display or something like that? Yeah.
You know, there's the hands-on aspect of it, but then there's also this the history of the industry.
Yeah, I'm always interested in history, and I think it would be important to have the history of the malting companies in Canada, like they first started in one of them started in 1907, and the other one, and Dominion Malting started in 1928.
Is there a history written of the malting companies in Canada?
You know, I'm not sure whether there is or not. But that would be one thing. You know, as far as the you know, the importance of barley and the malting process, you could easily do that on just a display, you know, a diagram on a sheet or something. And also the, you know, samples of barley and samples of malt. And actually, I should show you the difference between them. That was given to me when I retired, and
it's a little stained glass replica of a country elevator.
And this is barley here, and this is malt here.
Oh, okay. What a good gift.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Yeah.
And very attractive.
Yeah. And they put a black counter.
Yes, very nice. This leads me to ask about memorabilia. We do have, we've purchased a scanner as part of our project. And we're asking people, you know, do they have photographs or artifacts that they have collected over the years? That might be useful to have a record of.
Yeah.
That is a wonderful gift.
Yeah. Like, I don't have anything that...
Did Dominion Malting have archives of their history? Do they... Does one still exist in the... facilities here in Transcona?
Yeah. I doubt it, but I, you know, there was...
Sorry, if I take a picture of this?
Oh, sure. Yeah. There may be something out there, but I can't just think of... you know, there's certainly pictures, you know, old pictures of the plants when they first started and of these drums that I described, you know, and stuff like that. There's booklets with all those pictures in it. I know that. But there may even be a, I think, you know, there could be a malt fork out there, I think. And it's like when malting first started, it wasn't pneumatic malting. It was called floor malting, and it was in a building with a, I guess it would be a cement floor, a hard surface floor anyway. And it had lots of windows all the way around. And when the grain was, it was steeped the same way in steep tanks, and then it was put on this floor and leveled out and started to grow. And they used the air, you know, open all the windows and let the air come into the building. But they had malt forks, and it was, you know, they were about this wide. And yeah, and it was really an art. Like you had to turn the malt every so many hours and turn it, but keep it level. You know, when you were done, it had to be level the same when you started. And it was, I've never seen it done, but I've seen pictures of it, and I've talked to a guy from Hungary that worked for Labatt's that actually did it. But that's how they made malt initially. It was called floor malting as opposed to pneumatic malting, where the air is perforated floor and the air goes through.
Well, if in your travels or checking with people who are still working there, if there are some things that might be worthwhile to have scanned into our collection, that would be great. Because especially in a situation, the situation that's happened in the last 15 years, where there's been such a rapid turnover in ownership of various companies, a lot of this stuff just tends to get tossed.
Lost or tossed,
So, And I think I've asked most of the questions, unless there are questions you were dying to answer that we didn't ask.
Or something in your notes that you haven't,
yeah.
Yeah,
that
I
we
think
can't
I...
even think to ask.
That's right.
No, BMBRI about that and CMBTC. The barley coming in. Difference in the selection process changed mm-hmm. over the years. Different ownership. How the plant changed over the years.
Good.
No, I don't see anything else there that we haven't covered.
Great.
Appreciate how organized you were.
Yes, no. Thank you very much. Yes. You obviously did some thinking to put these things together. I had a question right from the very beginning when you were talking about your time at the university. So was Walter Buschek one of your instructors?
No, he wasn't, but he I know who he
yes.
was. Yeah.
Because we interviewed him and he was talking about plant breeding and...
Yeah, sure.
Yes, fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'd really like to thank you for the time you gave us for this project, and it's a valuable piece to the
yes.
picture that we're putting together. Thank you
very
much.
Appreciate it. I enjoyed doing it.